supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
It's made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. So I'll begin our show on entitlement with a story. Last year, I was in a parking lot, and because I drive a wheelchair van, I had to take up two spaces to accommodate my lift. A man drove past me and suggested pretty loudly that I was an anal sphincter, and I should mention he's not the first one that called me that, but there are several things about this brief interaction that I think are pretty interesting. First, he really had a sense that it was his personal space and I had taken it away from him. But the second one that was just as interesting to me was that because of his rage, he was almost literally blind to the fact that I was in a wheelchair. Now, the story, sure, it's unusual because of its extreme, but aren't we all, to a certain extent, so preoccupied with our own needs and our own sense of entitlement that we become blind to the world around us? Can we all relate to a certain extent? Well, joining us to explore these questions and many related questions are Gene Twenge and Peter Wybrow. Jean is author of Generation Me, and she's with San Diego State University, where she's an associate professor of psychology. Jean, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Peter Wybrow is director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. He's written American Mania and A Mood Apart. He's at peterwybrow.com. Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Dan.
Well, let's start. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's open this discussion about entitlement and narcissism. Are we more than previous generations? And how about our children? Peter, let's start with you. My so-called friend in the parking lot who referring to me as a variety of body parts. What do you think was going on with him?
How old was he then?
He was in his mid-40s, I guess. I
mean,
He looked like a grown-up on on the outside.
Right. Well, it's not true, but my sense is that there's a progression. And that younger people have basically been taught that the world is theirs, it's an oyster, and if they are able to express themselves, then they will get everything they want. And I guess he was expressing himself and wanting your parking space, basically. It's not entirely age-related, but I do think that as we go into the program, you could make a very good case for the fact that we've stumbled a little in developmental concepts of how we rear folks to work in a integrated civil society.
Well, let's start with labels and understanding what they are and what they're about. And Gina, I'd like you to tackle that. Most of the labels we throw around when it comes to this are pretty pejorative. You call someone a narcissist or say they're entitled, we're really not complimenting anyone there.
Well, that's true, because narcissism and entitlement are correlated with a lot of negative things, but we do have fairly precise definitions of what these terms mean, at least when we measure them through questionnaires, for example. So one of the standard measures of narcissism is called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, and that's meant to pick up on personality traits that go along with narcissism at a normal level. So we're not necessarily talking about someone who reaches the level of the clinical disorder, narcissistic personality disorder. This is just, you know, your normal narcissist walking around on the street who show these types of tendencies. So it has items on it like, if I ruled the world, it would be a better place, or I think I am a special person, or I like to be the center of attention. So there's 40 items on it. That's just three of them. And it is correlated with negative things, like not being able to take someone else's perspective, like the guy who was insulting you, you know, wasn't obviously was not taking your perspective, that you weren't being entitled. This was something that you actually needed to be able to get out of your own van.
So, Peter, you know, when we listen to Jean and some of the items on the inventory, that sounds like what you referred to earlier. That is precisely how we're raising our children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are special.
Yes, well, of course, in a sense, it's correct. We all are special. We're all unique. And in the same way as one's face is unique, one is, as a person, unique. But we also are social creatures. We live in social community. That's our great asset. It's only when working together that we've become dominant in the world, not by being individuals. Well, we'll be quickly outclassed by many other creatures on the planet. But I think that it's interesting because, as I'm sure Jean would agree, a certain amount of self-interest, a certain amount of personal pride and narcissism is absolutely essential to survival and to finding one's way and one's place in a complex world like we live in. But the fact is that we have probably developed, especially in our extraordinary affluent society, we have created the concept that we are all destined for great things. And it's a sort of a giant Ponzi scheme where everybody will win. But of course, that's impossible. And so I think the cultural deficit has been to think that constraint is no longer necessary. Empathic behavior, understanding the other person's position, is secondary to understanding one's own needs and therefore going for them.
Let's give us an example, please, of how narcissism helps.
Well, in the sense that I think it is, as you mentioned when you asked Jean the question, and she probably perhaps could expand on this better than I, but I think that the words themselves become very important. So self-interest, or self-love as it used to be called in the 18th century, is really a fundamental survival equipment. I mean, if you don't have self-interest and walk out into a busy street, you're likely to get killed. Mm. So in a sense, self-interest is important. It's when you expand it into the classical myth that the only person to be seen in the mirror is oneself, that it becomes pathological, because then again, it can be such that it endangers one. But the fundamental drive to take care of oneself is the foundation of narcissism, and I think that cultural reinforcement tends then to make one either very self-centered, or as one grows, become aware that one's own self-interest, which of course begins to change around the age of 8 or 9, is actually the same as everybody else's self-interest, and it's only when one integrates that and empathically understands the other person's position that life becomes not only more interesting, but also actually more rewarding. And that's the final step in moral development, if you will, that perhaps we haven't made in this particular instance.
That's a tough lesson to learn if we're not being helped. Jean, so according to what Peter's saying, and according to what we know as mental health professionals, that it is early on, early adolescence, pre-adolescence, that we begin to realize there are others, and it's the development of a sense of empathy and compassion for others that hopefully continues to develop. Apparently, that is arrested to a certain extent. That's part of the reason why you called it Generation Me in your book. So what's happening? Why?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So yeah, at one time, that lesson was taught fairly carefully to children and adolescents, that we should consider other people's feelings, that it's not all about you. Parents used to say, who do you think you are? Now they say, what do you want for dinner, princess? So we've really switched. We tell kids you shouldn't care what other people think of you, and do what's right for you, and you can be anything you want to be, and believe in yourself, and anything is possible. And here's the problem. Here's the outcome. It's not just a perception that young people are now more narcissistic. There's actual data on this. I was able to find data on 16,000 college students who filled out the narcissistic personality inventory between 1982 and 2006, and there's been a dramatic increase in narcissistic personality traits over that time. There are more narcissists now. If you look at people who score higher, they answer the majority of the questions in the narcissistic direction, that's now one out of four college students. So we've got a serious problem now where it's not people, sure, they have that basic sense of self-worth, which we all want to have, but it's moved beyond that into narcissistic and entitled thinking where people lack empathy, they have problems in relationships because it's all about them and they don't have consideration for others, and they lash out with aggression when they're insulted. That's another characteristic of narcissism. So we've gone from building a basic sense of self-worth in our children and our teenagers into telling them that they're the greatest things ever and nobody else matters. So we've built this narcissism.
Well, let's. I'd like to take a step back and look at even the bigger picture. When President Bush tried to privatize Social Security, he said, it's your money and you're entitled to it. Well, Social Security was founded on the premise of the collective good. And, you know, I don't think it's fair to simply compare two presidents. I think the question that begs, and I'll turn to you, Peter, is, has our culture evolved from the greater good to it's your money and you're entitled to it?
I think so. I mean, it was interesting, of course, that that was rejected because at some level, the rational mind does begin to kick in, and one realizes that one cannot be completely isolated and provide one's own health care, one's own education, etc., etc. We do have to be interdependent. Of course, that was the great concept behind the use of the term the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth of Virginia or other such integrated places in the New World where individuals not only voted, but they recognized the importance of others in what they did together in building the colony. So I think that culture has changed over that long period of time. And one of the things that drives it, I think, is the consumer society. We spend an enormous amount of effort as a culture now essentially courting young people. We spend about $260 billion, in fact, on telling young children that what they want is the most important thing because that helps us maintain our growing economy. And, of course, as you and I have spoken about before on this program, we have done that in such a superb way that we're now almost bankrupt in a general sense.
Well,
so I think that that particular, I won't blame it all on the merchant, but I think that the marketing, the necessity of marketing to children has in fact increased their narcissism. The second point very quickly is that the way we've built our culture is that parents very often have little time now to spend with their children compared to even 30 or 40 years ago. And so the alternative is to give them things rather than their own time. And this extends, you know, everything from giving them the television set to keep them quiet to lavishing many presents upon them at times when perhaps just a moment of their own time would be far more beneficial.
There is another factor that I heard a lecture years ago by Martin Seligman, who's here at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's well known for his research on depression and helplessness. But he said one of the cultures is our lack of external adversity in this culture. He said since World War II, we have not had an external adversity that has united us. I mean, we had Vietnam, but that certainly didn't unite us. It divided us. We had it for a moment after 9/11 when we were united. But, you know, even in Iraq, it's not an enemy that unites us. It really doesn't have an impact on us. And he said as soon as we stopped having a common cause as a culture, we started just to become more absorbed with ourselves. I think it was an interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's a classic social psychology phenomenon when people are fighting a common enemy that people unite. And we haven't really had that within Generation Me's lifetime outside of the brief period around 9/11. So instead, what's emphasized now to so many young people is the world is increasingly competitive and you just have to look out for yourself and look out for number one. So that's what I hear very often from young people when I tell them about the study. Is they say, well, we have to be this way. We have to be narcissistic because the world is increasingly competitive. The problem with that is it's based on a false premise. Narcissists are not any more successful. They think they are. They're legends in their own minds. But narcissism doesn't help you succeed, partially because you alienated other people. And with parenting, you know, the changes that create narcissism seems to be more permissive parenting. I have to disagree about the amount of time spent. When you look at sociological studies, parents actually spend more time interacting with their children now than they used to. That thing about helicopter parenting actually seems to be somewhat correct, maybe because parents have fewer children now, and when they do interact with them, it's more direct, and they think it's not safe to let the kids go run around outside, so they have to be supervised all the time.
Are they more permissive, though?
Absolutely. There's some evidence to suggest that parenting has become more permissive. And I think if you just look around anecdotally, you can certainly see lots of examples of that. It's more child-centered. It's more that parents are asking the children what they want all the time. So that part I completely agree with, that there are the material needs that are being met. And also just the day-to-day interaction with children puts the child's needs much more, you know, people ask one, two-year-old children, do you want to go to the park now, and what do you want for dinner, things like this, and that used to be very uncommon. Parents now say the number one thing they want in kids is for them to be tolerant and open-minded and think for themselves, and it used to be that one of the biggest things parents said that was important for kids, for them to learn, was obedience, and that's dropped way down in importance in surveys.
Interesting. Well, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to actually listen to some kids. We went to Temple University here in Philadelphia and talked to some kids about narcissism and entitlement to find out whether they felt that these monikers of Generation Me actually fit. So that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about narcissism, entitlement. Are we a more self-absorbed society and why? And maybe more important, what can we do about it? My guests are Jean Twenge. She's author of Generation Me, and she's an associate professor of psychology at San Diego State University. I'm also joined by Peter Weibrow. He's director of the Semmel Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. He has written American Mania and A Mood Apart. Our number, 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Longwood Gardens and the Fair Play Foundation present an evening with futurist and author Richard Louvre, Thursday, April 17th. Louvre's book, Last Child in the Woods, helped spark a national conversation about the growing disconnect between children and nature. Louvre will speak about the community, family, and ways to re-engage young people with the earth. For tickets, 610-388-1000 or longwoodgardens.org. Longwood Gardens supports WHYY.
The demand for oil increases and prices rise. Political and military alliances are being redrawn, with oil-rich countries like Russia and Venezuela gaining power. Michael Clare calls it the new international energy order. That's the subject of his new book. We'll talk with Clare on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. My guests are Jean Twenge. She is author of Generation Me, Associate Professor of Psychology at San Diego State University. And also nearby her in L.A. is Dr. Peter Weibrow. He's director of the Semmel Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. He's written American Mania and A Mood Apart. We're talking about narcissism, and in that context, our intern, Amanda Ray, spoke with fellow students at Temple University and asked them, are we entitled brats?
I wouldn't agree with that personally. I sort of feel that the generation lower to us is a lot more bratty and snobbish. They don't have respect for their elders whatsoever, and that just how they dress, too, and the amount of how old they're getting at such a young age is very disturbing to me.
I think we're definitely spoiled, but I don't know if we're brats.
I mean, I think it depends how you're raised, honestly. Like, if your parents give you everything and you never have to work for anything, then, yeah, I think you end up being a brat. But I don't think all kids are. I don't think it's fair to say that about our entire generation.
Society is, like, it's building up, so as we get more and more advanced, we expect a little bit more. So I think that can be true.
Would you say that you're grateful for what you have?
Of course I'm grateful for what I have.
I've been places that I've seen things that make me realize that what I have is a blessing.
Definitely, yeah. I didn't have everything handed to me, and I appreciate what I do have, especially now, like, living on my own as a college student.
What do you want or expect for your future?
I hope for good things.
I expect to be successful and happy and just be able to provide for myself for things that I do want.
I hope it's a greener future. I think, yeah, Philadelphia itself is getting pretty disgusting, and I hope that there's a way that we can turn that around.
I know I expect to be in charge of something.
18 to 25-year-olds are considered the look-at-me generation. What do you think? Do you think we are?
Definitely. Look at American Idol. Age limit's like 25, so that's perfect.
In a sense, I guess so. I mean, this is we're exposed to VH1 and MTV constantly, and then all of the magazines that we have that are so focused on rich and famous people. It makes sense that that would be a product of our generation.
I think we are. We are the ones that are going to school, just coming out of school, getting into the work industry, and pretty much without that age group, you know, you're stuck with old people and young people in high school. So we are the top-notch kids.
The top goals of that age range are fortune and fame. Does that sound right to you? Do you think it's true?
It completely does. I mean, people are so focused on just making all this money, but it almost seems like a hollow goal, because what really makes people happy? I mean, no one has any idea, and just because you have money doesn't mean that you're going to be satisfied with life.
That seems pretty on point, but there's also people that don't need that to be happy.
I think so, but I think it's also true of other generations. You know, everyone has that dream of being that sports star or that music star, so I don't think that's anything that's new.
That does sound about right, fortune. I don't know if everybody wants to be famous, but everybody wants to have money and be successful, so yeah.
4 years of school, what do you feel like you're entitled to after graduation? What kind of job, what kind of money? Like, what would be ideal for you?
I don't expect that much, because I understand as being right out of college that you're not entitled to much and that you have to make your way up the ladder.
I mean, ideal would be an amazing paying job, a job that has the hours that I want and the benefits I want, but what am I entitled to? Nothing. I went to school, I got my education, and now it's up to me to make things happen for the rest of my life.
A job where they pay for me to go on vacation and give me lots of incentives, because college is not cheap.
That was our intern, Amanda Ray, speaking with fellow students at Temple University in Philadelphia. I've got to say, Gene and Peter, there was one thing that jumped out at me, and that was that young person who said, "Well, of course we're the ones. If it's the only thing besides us are old people and kids."
Yeah, that was a crack. He said, "We are the top notch kids," and I'm like, "Oh, but you're not narcissistic."
I'm thinking, all right, I was called an old people and I was called an anal sphincter. I'd rather be in the parking lot. I like the guy in the parking lot better.
He's looking pretty good now,
man. So I'll tell you one thing that emerges for me is that there's a theme here where the kids are saying, "No, not me, but the younger generation."
That was fascinating too.
So I wonder if that's what we are doing right now.
You know, it's tempting to think so, and I hear that from a lot of people. Oh, older people have always said young people are narcissistic. But the thing is, this the data are pretty definitive on this, because the data set that I looked at, it was young people at different eras. So it was baby boomers in college and Gen X in college, and now Generation Me in college. So people are exactly the same age, and they're describing themselves. It has nothing to do with what older people think of them. It's about what they say about themselves and their personality. And it's not just narcissism. It's across the spectrum. Self-esteem is higher. Self-satisfaction is higher. Young people are now much more confident that they're going to be really great at important adult roles. They're more individualistic. There's just a swath of findings showing that over the generations, people have just grown much more focused on themselves.
So before we go to the phones, let me just ask you, Gene, you said self-esteem is higher. Tell us what that correlates with. Does it correlate with success or happiness or any of the things we assume?
Well, self-esteem does correlate with happiness, but somewhat to many people's surprise, it does not correlate with success. So there's a definitive review came out on this a few years ago, and self-esteem does not lead to good grades or good behavior or good work performance. It tends to work the other way around. When you do good things, that helps you develop true self-esteem. So the idea we've had over the last few decades that you can build up children's self-esteem without any real basis, just you're special, just for being you, that type of thing, and expect that to lead to good outcomes, doesn't work that way. That puts the cart before the horse. What it does do is build up this individualism, and the way most of those self-esteem programs do things, particularly, for example, about being special and how you should just focus on yourself, that's actually crossing over into narcissism instead of self-esteem, which the basic difference between the two is that narcissists are missing the piece about caring for other people and relationships that people high in self-esteem have.
You know, Dan, that reminds you probably of the thing you must have learned in during your PhD, which is the old marshmallow test, which is where you put the marshmallow in front of the child at the age of 4, tell them you're going to be out for a bit, and when you come back, you'll give them 2 if they don't eat it. And that if whether they eat it or not correlates extraordinarily well with outcome in success later on in life. It's so it's restraint, not narcissism, as I think Gene is inferring, that tends to correlate, and that is something which is very difficult to learn when you're being given everything.
Yeah, that I do remember that study, and there was an extraordinarily high correlation between that restraint. Let's go to the phones. Our lines are lit up, and we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Leo on line 4.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The observation I would like to contribute is that I think the schools are part of the problem as well, in that I've noticed some primary grade school teachers who offer a gold star to every child, regardless of whether their work that was turned in was superlative or not. And I think in the way of they're trying to build the children's self-esteem, they've in fact destroyed the ones that are achievers and are more intelligent, or maybe that's the wrong word, but at least are more industrious and work more for their grades.
Well, I think you make an interesting observation. We're going to take you off the air because we got a bad connection, and I'll turn that over to you, Gene. And I want to ask you the counterbalancing question that people of my generation, and I'll talk about me specifically, that I had my self-esteem crushed in school because I did badly and there was nothing to bolster me. And that really did injure me for many, many years post-school.
So clearly what we need is a balance. So, you know, obviously we should not be, you know, telling kids you're a failure, you're awful, something like that. It needs to be balanced with these types of restraint and self-control lessons. So you need to give feedback and say, you know, that wasn't very good, but here's how you can do better next time. We don't have to be yelling at kids or telling them they're stupid or horrible or anything like that, but telling them how they can improve is a good thing and not a bad thing. We can learn from failure. But what's happened in the last few decades is we have this idea nobody should fail. So everybody gets a trophy on the sports team is the very popular thing for Generation Me. So kids and teenagers now, some 20-somethings, because it started, you know, in the 80s and 90s, were exposed to this idea that no matter who wins or loses, everybody gets the same size trophy. And that resembles real life so much. That's the problem, and not learning this lesson about how to fail and how to learn from that and how to learn from mistakes.
I tell people that all of the great wisdom in my life has come from either failure or some really stupid decisions.
Me too.
Yeah, I think that's the case with most of us. You know, our Amanda, when she was interviewing those girls, those kids, referred to their expectations of the future. And she was referring to a study that showed over 70% of Americans believe it's only a matter of time till they become rich or famous, which is really shocking. I mean, how is it, and I'll turn to you, Peter, on this, how is it that we're not taking in real live external data like the economy, the job
I
market,
talk about that in
skills.
American Mania, actually, that fascinating statistic. But, you know, the tragedy here, actually, Dan, if you look at the flip side of the coin, is that the same group of individuals who have such self-esteem actually also suffer greatly from depression, anxiety, and so on. If you, the persons in my generation, your generation, we have far less depression and anxiety than do people in my daughter's generation. And this has been repeated again and again in epidemiological studies. So, and then, of course, there are the classic studies that show, as Jean was talking about, that actually based here at UCLA, entering freshmen are much more interested now in themselves than they are in caring for the environment or anything else. So there's a fascinating flip side where as it moves towards self-interest, it also seems to correlate, or at least be associated with, rising levels of personal mental anguish, among other things.
Well,
and of course, if you look at the country at large, in general, you find that we're 49th percent in literacy in the world, and other such parameters, you can see that we have a lot of self-delusion in terms of how wonderful we really are.
How wonderful we think we are, but, you know, one of my supervisors once said years ago that the world is full of people trying to be filet mignon when deep down we know we're meatballs. And, you know, the truth of the matter is deep down we do know we're meatballs, and that, you know, there's that disconnect between who we think we should be and who we feel we really are. And I think that's the source of a great deal of suffering, because we never quite get there, even though we think we should be there.
Well, it's in the evolution of one's own self, of course, the last couple of stages where you move from following the rules to being considerate of others and having a personal code of conduct, they're very, very difficult. And there's a lot of evidence that they don't really develop until after adolescence. And so it may well be that, I don't know what you think about this, Jean, but maybe as we move beyond 18 to 25 age group, that there's a course correction there where people become less narcissistic. Does any of your research suggest that?
We have some cross-sectional data suggesting that older people are less narcissistic than younger people, but it's tough to tell whether it's age or generation that's causing that.
So you haven't got continuity
studies. It certainly does make sense
yet.
That as people get older and come to reality, that that narcissism is going to go down. But it also, if you kind of look just across the culture, I'm now in my next book going to move on beyond Generation Me and into the whole culture, because our whole culture has moved in this direction of narcissism, of the credit crisis, for example, and we all feel entitled to the big house, whether we can afford it or not, which is why we're in the mess we're in at the moment, and all of the stuff about celebrity worship and plastic surgery is going way up, and just so many things across the board, across all generations, seem to be heading in the direction of narcissism.
Well, I also think the number of people taking antidepressants, psychotropic medication, also fits in that area, because we feel we are entitled to be happy all the time, and that we equate now sadness with pathology, even grief, even normal grief. There's something wrong with that, and we need to get rid of that. We're entitled to our happiness and stability. So it's,
and we're not valuing the things that actually lead to happiness. Like relationships with other people. So, yeah, I talk about this in Generation Me as well. So the subtitle of the book is Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever Before, because of all the data on anxiety and depression. So this focus on ourselves is not necessarily making us happy. The self is not a great basis for mental health.
No.
For that, we need others.
No.
And I hope we will also pull back a little bit to look at the culture, as Jean was inferring, because I think that actually it is a much more complex and broader issue. I mean, the fact is that we do have individuals who buy houses, but we also have people who, for their own greed, are promoting the notion of buying the house because that's how they make a lot of money. And also the credit card system is an extraordinary example of how culturally we have embedded greed without any regulation. And this, as you know, I've written about extensively, this has come, I think, from a major change in the way in which our market society works. And
well,
so I don't think we can, I think we have to back up, as I suspect Jean's doing in her next book, to look at these things from a cultural standpoint and to create a vision that goes beyond the individual. It's otherwise we will never be able to find any course correction here.
Well, I want to do both. When we come back from our break, we're going to take another call first. I want to take a step back, but I also want to look in very closely and see what we can do about this. But let's hear from Olivia first on line two, Al.
Hi, thank you. I think some of the things I originally called about have been talked about, but I wanted to make a few comments. One is that there was something earlier about kids making decisions versus being obedient, and I think that's very black and white, and that somewhere in the middle is the ideal, where maybe you ask a kid, what do you want for dinner? And then you say, okay, what does your brother want? What does your dad want? What do I want? And then talk about it and actually help them learn to take into account other people's feelings. And then another thing I believe is that confidence is not under narcissism. And if you dig down for people who act narcissistic, I don't think confidence is the basis for that. I think it's lack of confidence. And I think the real big elephant in the room is profitable companies that make money on getting us to not feel good, so we want more and more, and they push it towards us. And the drugs are the same thing. People are prescribing drugs before they actually get people to work things out or say, hey, you want to feel good about yourself? Go volunteer at a halfway house for battered women or a soup kitchen. That's what makes people feel good, but the drug companies don't make any money doing that. So there's a lot of money being made in this whole system that I think we all fall victim to from the time we're very little, especially this generation, which has grown up with MTV and all the other things that were discussed.
Agreed with everything you said. However, I do want to mention that I'm kindred spirits with Peter and Jean in the way they're looking at the culture and this issue. But I just read an article where voluntarism is actually up in this culture, and it's been climbing over the last.
That's because it's required
decade.
Now to graduate from high school. That's why it's up.
You know,
involuntary volunteering.
You think that's skewing the...
I have no doubt that's skewing it. If it's required, of course it's going to go up.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's take our break, and I do want to come back and talk about the underlying stress that both causes this and gets fed by this, and what we can do about it. My guests are Jean Twenge, author of Generation Me. She's an associate professor of psychology at San Diego State. Dr. Peter Weibrow is director of the Semmel Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA, and he's written American Mania and A Mood Apart. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
For news that's concise.
This really was a day when the president wanted to send a signal to
some helpful advice.
You want to ask them, what kind of credentials do you have? What are your qualifications? What services do you offer?
And always something nice.
There are ponies here. 5, 6, 7. And it looks like there's a foal out there.
Join us on NPR's Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about how our culture and especially our kids are moving increasingly towards a sense of narcissism, self-absorption, and entitlement. My guests are Dr. Peter Weibrow, who's director of the Semmel Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. Jean Twenge is author of Generation Me, and she's an associate professor of psychology at San Diego State University. Well, if you've ever been to an airport on a snowy day or tried to travel American Airlines recently when flights were canceled, chances are you have seen people, and maybe been one of them, people at their worst, screaming in attendance, demanding that something be done. We expect immediate results. But the fact of the matter is, we live in a world where delays just happen. I asked Dr. Michael Boehm, director of the Penn Stress Management Program, if this is a big source of stress for people.
Well, yeah, it's not a source of stress. I think that it might be the source of stress. I mean, when we're under pressure and we are frightened or anxious, worried about what will happen, we regress. We go back to more primitive, earlier ways of functioning. And sometimes we go all the way back to the time when we were the only person who mattered. Me, 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 me. And that's not the way that the world works. So if you're maneuvering from that attitude, you're going to take some hard knocks and things aren't going to go as well. It sure does work better if you can stop before you have that tantrum and just take maybe one breath long enough to think about, what do I really want from this? Is it really going to help me if I pound on the desk of the person in front of me and demand that I get what I want? Or would it be better to slow down, to take a breath, and to look at them and say, help me out here. I really have to get home for whatever it is, for my kid's performance in this play, for my daughter's rehearsal dinner for her wedding. Can you help me? And to let them know how you feel without blowing them away or shaking your fist at them. Stop and notice what's happening and think about what you really want to get and what your real choices are.
And what if none of that works and I still can't get home? Now what?
Well, then you have to acknowledge, as we all do, that we can't get everything that we want. It isn't going to happen. We get some of it some of the time, and the rest we have to accept. We can be angry, we can be upset, we can be anxious. It's not going to change what happens. So maybe it would be better to just accept that life has its ups and downs, to take a step back and to appreciate the perspective that usually we do okay. And when you get right down to it, whatever it is that happened fundamentally is really okay. You're going to get by, and in the long run, it doesn't matter that much.
So once I've acknowledged that the battle is lost, I can give up fighting for what should be or could be or what I need, and maybe pay simple attention to where I am.
Right. It's the only way that you're going to find any peace in your life, because you're going to continue to miss planes, to have disappointments and frustrations. And if every time that happens, it feels like we've lost a critical battle, that we're about to lose the war, that it could be the end of the world, tomorrow is not going to be so much fun.
That was Dr. Michael Boehm. He runs the Penn Program for Stress Management here in Philadelphia. Peter and Gina, I think what Michael was talking about right at the very end, I mean, he was talking about once we know we're not going to get what we feel we deserve or feel we need or feel we must have, then we suffer, and we need to just acknowledge our suffering and know when the battle's over and stop fighting. But is that realistic? Could the guy in the parking lot way back in the beginning of the show who called me a name, could he have known that in that moment in the middle of his road rage?
Well, unfortunately, you know, it takes a certain maturity to do what was being discussed there, and that's, I think, what we're talking about today. But the advice is magnificent. That's exactly where, if we could all come to that mindset, we would be in better order. I'm having sat in the Chicago airport for 4.5 hours on my way to North Carolina this weekend. I entirely understand that the what looked like a refugee camp would have been a lot more organized if, in fact, we had all had that mindset. So I think that the ability to get to that point is really the question, and whether we may be a little bit off target in terms of the cultural mores that we are expressing, because it doesn't allow the average individual to have that type of insight and perspective, and perhaps we need to think that through a little more in a comprehensive way, not just in regard to the individual, but in terms of where the individual lives, the sort of environment in which they grew up in. I don't mean just the environment, I mean the urban environment, and et cetera, et cetera. How do we create communities that support the family? How do we have social policies that support the fact that now 50 or 60%, maybe 70% of mothers work? I mean, these are things that we haven't yet caught up with, but most other advanced countries have thought through much more carefully than we have.
So, Gene, what's your take on how change happens, could happen, should happen for this younger generation? I mean, you know, Peter's talking about, you know, macro. Michael Boehm was talking about micro. And one of the things Michael suggested, as Michael was talking, I was thinking that expectations cause suffering, period. It is just that simple. Whether they're reasonable or unreasonable, expectations cause suffering. But we need to know we're suffering as individuals and as a culture before we can do anything, I would think.
Yeah, so starting with that point is a good one. And let me actually start with something that the caller said before we went to break about, she said, well, you know, narcissism is caused by a lack of self-confidence. Actually, that's not true. When we look at measuring self-concept in a very subtle way, like with reaction time, deep down inside, narcissists are not insecure. Deep down inside, they think that they're awesome. The reason that's important is that we shouldn't continue with these programs of thinking that, you know, even with a narcissistic person, we just need to amp up their self-esteem and focus on them feeling great about themselves and tell them how unique they are. There's still a lot of programs and still a lot of emphasis throughout the culture, parenting, teachers, media, for kids and even some for adults about think about how you are different from other people and how you are unique. That's fine, but why are we emphasizing that so much?
every war, every atrocity has been started by, those people are different from me, let's go kill them. We should be thinking instead about what we have in common as human beings. That also really helps in that situation in the airport, too. Is this another human being across from you? And they're standing behind that desk, and maybe they've been standing there for 7 hours. And they might not be stuck in the airport like you, but they might have had a tough day. And just thinking about what you have in common with others, and that we can come back to that principle instead of just being so crazily focused on competition and self-love and everybody else get out of my way, and come back to these basic principles that we're all human.
Well, I have always believed very deeply that the path to mental health is through the pursuit of social health, and if we don't pursue the latter, we will never achieve the former. And the two of you seem to be saying that narcissism and entitlement are really a failure of empathy. It seems to me that anxiety interferes with empathy. Peter?
Well, it does, but I actually completely agree with Jean, what she just said. I think that people get anxious, certainly, when they find themselves cornered, because it's a very primitive response to feeling that control is about to be lost. But actually, what Jean was saying about the understanding of others, it provides, in a peculiar sense, the control that
right.
flakes the anxiety, because
right.
then you realize you're one of a large number,
and
if you pull together, you can even start to tell stories about, you know, the fact that, oh, well, my goodness me, I was on my way to X,
and et cetera, et cetera. Peter, it's that kind of connection that gives us the security, ultimately, we long for. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a really interesting and important conversation. My guests have been Dr. Jean Twenge and Peter Wybrow. Twenge is an associate professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She's written Generation Me. Wybrow's director of the Semmel Institute of Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA, and he's written American Mania. Well, you can listen to archive edition of Voices at whyy.org. You can reach me at my website, drdangottlieb.com. This coming Thursday, the 17th, I'll be speaking at the Family Guidance Center Corporation in New Jersey on what makes us human. For more information, check out my website. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped us in today's production. Our intern is Amanda Reyes. Our associate producer is Elisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends. Day to